Well, thanks. And I'm going to do more because I've got Dan Kovalik, a friend of yours, coming on in the second half. So everyone else stay tuned for that. Thanks again, Dimitri. Okay.
Take care, Chris.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, it's accepted now. Journalists and activists can expect to be harassed when they arrive home to the countries of the free world. Their phones, cameras, and recording equipment may be seized, and they themselves detained, questioned, intimidated, and even arrested. All this for the crime of not towing the line on stories deemed sensitive to either their own government or one of its allies. And it's not just upon arrival this treatment is meted out, as discovered in Britain by longtime Palestine activist Sarah Wilkinson, whose home was violated by a platoon of balaclava-clad machine gun-toting security men, and she roughly arrested. Dan Kovalik's a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's been back and forth to the Donbass region of Russia five times in the last couple of years, talking to the people there and relaying their stories to his fellow Americans, and that has not gone unnoticed. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interest, and The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Welcome back to the program, Dan.
Chris, it's always a pleasure.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, of course, you know that. Well, Dan, now you're just freshly on the ground, back from your fifth trip to the Donbass and Russia. Tell me, Dan, now, what's life like now for people in the places that you visited?
Well, so I spent most of the time in Donetsk and Mariupol, and for the most part, you wouldn't know that a war is happening. Life is, you know, largely return to normal. People are out working, shopping, going to restaurants. There's been amazing reconstruction, in particular in Mariupol, because that's a very secure area now, secured from shelling, which Donetsk is not entirely secured. There is periodic shelling from Ukraine on Donetsk, but Mariupol has been secured, and the Russians have done put about $5 billion in doing new construction and reconstruction, and it's pretty amazing, you know, and we're led to believe that Mariupol in particular is like an occupied city by Russia, and there's no evidence of such a thing. You know, you don't see many soldiers on the streets. You don't see many checkpoints. Mostly, if you see a checkpoint, it's between cities, not within cities. So, yeah, there's a feeling of normalcy in these locations.
Well, is that something unique to that area? We hear over here about the Kursk offensive, that there's thousands of casualties on the Russian side. Is it only in Donetsk that they're having this lull, or is this something that is enjoyed across Russia?
Well, it's certainly being enjoyed in more areas. In Donetsk, the places I've been, Donetsk, Luhansk, and Mariupol, but there's certainly some areas, you know, you mentioned Kursk. I think Kursk is largely becoming secure, but you're right. I mean, there was an incursion into it by Ukrainian forces, though they didn't get far into it. You know, they mostly took over farmland and that sort of thing. And I think everyone, even the Ukrainian military, agrees now that was a very bad strategic move on their part, that they got beat very badly by the Russians, though they had some initial gains. And Russia recently, in the last couple of weeks, has moved farther west into Ukraine and taken some areas from where shelling was happening, where Ukraine was shelling from into places like Donetsk. So I think there's more security, but, you know, it's a huge border. And so there's certainly places that are insecure. Actually, I think the one area that's getting hammered a lot is Belgorod, which is a city within, you know, mainland Russia. And they're getting hit quite a bit. So, but again, in the Donbass itself, it's becoming largely settled.
Well, there's at least one person doesn't agree that the Kursk incursion was disastrous, and that is Zelensky himself. He released just today a 5-point victory plan, he calls it, and one of the 5 points of that plan are more Kursk-like incursions. In fact, he actually cites Kursk as the model of the five steps to victory for Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I think Zelensky, well, first of all, he's motivated by wanting to keep the war going, because as the war keeps going, he keeps getting more money that he's enriching himself and his cronies with. So we have to start from that premise. And again, the idea that Kursk or another incursion like that make any sense from a military point of view, again, I think is disputed by almost everyone at this point. Ukraine threw a lot of its better forces and equipment against Kursk, again, only to be repelled ultimately and destroyed. And in fact, it reminds me of what is it, Pyrrhus, who said, you know, the where the idea of a Pyrrhic victory comes from. You know, one or two more victories like that, and it'll be the end of Ukraine. So, I think Zelensky is just at best incorrect on that score, or just, you know, I think can't see through his own corruption. In truth,
well. The venality of the Zelensky regime is pretty difficult to dispute, but even that, it seems huge to consider. This 5-point plan, it sounds to me like he's unhinged from reality. He begins, Zelensky does, in this 5-point plan. And again, this just came out. This is today, October 16th. He begins by saying that his 5-point plan begins with NATO membership. I'm not sure who's going to have to tell him, you know? And then goes on to say Kursk was, you know, is a good model for beating Russia. But he also mentioned something kind of shady and scary, a non-nuclear strategic deterrence, the details of which he said he won't reveal. But it sounds like some, I don't know, maybe dirty bomb and or something to deter Russian use of nuclear first strike or something. It's a bit of a mystery. Do you know anything more about it?
Well, the one thing he's been doing is attacking, trying to attack nuclear power plants. We know in Zaporozhye for some time he's been trying to do that, and in Kursk as well. So I think that's one idea, is to try to blow up a nuclear power plant. Of course, the other thing that's looming out there is this plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine that could be used deep within Russia's territory. Quite interestingly, you probably saw that Joe Biden was to attend a meeting in Europe where this was going to be green-lit, this plan to send those missiles. He canceled going there and now is saying he'll make a decision on that after the November 5th presidential elections in the United States, which is an interesting move. And some, you know, see that as a very clear indication that when he does decide, he will decide in the affirmative to send those missiles. So I do think that's part of Zelensky's plan as well. And again, Zelensky is not going to do anything.
But Biden's not going to be deciding anything after November 5th.
Well,
no matter what happens.
That's probably true. But when I say Biden, you know, I use that term loosely. I don't think he's deciding anything now, Chris, given his mental capacity. But whoever is sitting in the White House making these decisions.
Well, that's a good point, though. Who is making these decisions? You know, really, I mean, yeah, the long range missiles is point two of the 5-step, along with the Kursk incursions of Zelensky saying, yeah, this is a good idea to keep sending these long range missiles, something that has got Putin finally, some would argue, off of his throne and into action. Well, anyway, about the venality, though, Zelensky's fourth idea for victory is to offer special cut rate prices on Ukrainian minerals and other extractivist wealth that the region holds. This proving the point people have been saying for years, that this is just a Western plan to loot the country.
Yes. Well, in fact, again, Senator Lindsey Graham appeared with Zelensky a few weeks ago and right in front of him said that's why we're there in Ukraine, is to go after their trillions of dollars of minerals. And of course, we know that U.S. firms like BlackRock and Vanguard now have concessions, you know, representing about 30% of Ukrainian territory. And so it's also the war now is about defending those concessions. So there's very little secret about that now.
Yeah, well, just to finish off the 5-point plan for victory, Zelensky says that there'll be permanent American bases after included with the NATO membership, of course, that America will make Ukraine its new center of deterrence against Russia in the future or something, I guess, is his idea, that it'll be a kind of new Germany or Poland for Russian bases. Do you think there's an appetite in the United States for a mega base in Ukraine?
I think at some point that was probably part of the plan, but I don't think at this point that that's realistic. I think that Ukraine's utility to the West is waning. I think they want the minerals and they want some of the land, but I don't see them putting a base in there now. It would be too vulnerable, I think, and the Russians would never stand for it. That would lead to World War III, I think. I mean, if we haven't gotten there before then, but I don't see that as a realistic possibility.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dan Kovalik. Dan's a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defendant, journalist, author, and filmmaker. As I said, he's been back and forth 5 times now in the last couple of years to the Donbass region in Russia. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, The Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. His latest is The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters, and Why You Should Care. That book, your book, Dan, came out before the latest incarnation of horror that we're seeing unfolding before us in an ever-tightening spiral into the netherworld. Dan, when you say that the utility of Ukraine is waning, how much of that, or does any of that, have to do with what's going on in Palestine and the so-called Middle East?
Well, they certainly seem to be running on parallel tracks. I mean, I think, again, this global conflagration that we seem to be facing is going to emanate from probably one of those two areas, either Ukraine or the Middle East. These are all wars for domination. It's all about the West, and in particular the United States, trying to maintain its hegemony over the world. In that sense, they're very similar conflicts, though the one in the Middle East is grisly in a way that I certainly have never seen in my lifetime. It's not to say that those types of grisly crimes haven't happened, but, you know, to see these terrible videos and photos every 15 minutes on social media of children being murdered in Gaza and Lebanon, you saw Israel attacked an ancient Christian community in the north of Beirut, I believe yesterday. This is just reaching levels of barbarity that are hard to contemplate. And many of us just feel so grief-stricken by what's happening.
Yeah, well, in sitting down to writing, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, you can't write something one day and not have it topped by some fresh atrocity the next. It's and this has been going on for a year now. I mean, the atrocities, of course, are much more longstanding, not only in Israel or in the Palestine at the hands of Israel, but you know, across the world. But now there definitely does seem to be a ramping up of intensity and intent that I don't see as mistaken. The congressperson in the U.S., Mast, he is a former and I think still serving in some capacity officer in the IDF. The guy without the legs that went into Congress wearing his IDF uniform, which I didn't think was even legal, but in American law, but I'm not American. But he says today that he wants American soldiers, which are stationed now in this conflict. He wants the IDF soldiers to receive, or Americans that serve for the IDF or in Israel to receive the same kind of pension and benefits that American soldiers do, if I'm getting this right here, which I'm certain I've fucked it up, but something to this effect. What do you think about this, the American soldiery serving in and with the Israeli forces?
Well, I think it's quite troubling. I think the U.S. is becoming much more involved in this conflict in the Middle East. That's, of course, what Netanyahu wants. I think you will see greater involvement of the United States. Clearly, the U.S. is working on a plan with Israel to attack Iran, for example. And that sort of, you know, if there's a major war with Iran, Israel could not do that alone. The U.S. would have to be involved. Some people were even talking about a draft, drafting Americans to fight in such a war, which would be a terribly unpopular war, by the way. I think that would go over like a lead balloon. But I think we're reaching the phase where, you know, the U.S. is ready to go all in the Middle East in support of a war that is just indefensible. I want to specifically, you know, mention what's happening in the north of Gaza right now. I mean, where they're starving out 200,000 people, mm-hmm. threatening to displace or kill, you know, a total of 400,000 people. And you're seeing very little of this being covered in the mainstream press. The levels of barbarity there are just unfathomable, and we're barely hearing about it.
Yeah, well, we're all siloed in our own communication devices. I see it every day, all day long. I haven't watched the mainstream media for quite a long time. I'm surprised to hear you say that they're not. I mean, how is it possible that it's not being covered? We've seen that the Italian prime minister has said that that Italy will sell no more weapons to Israel. In Ireland, they're up in arms because the UN peacekeepers are under fire. The Irish UN peacekeeping contingent is under fire directly by the IDF at the Lebanon border. Ireland is up in arms. How can these stories go unreported in the press in the U.S. and they still remain to pretend any kind of credibility?
Yeah, and they are going unreported. I mean, I was just talking to friends today who actually are very, you know, they keep up on the news. And I mentioned the Irish UN troops holding the line in Lebanon. They had not heard of that. I mean, it's just not getting reported on here in the United States. you're getting a very skewed view of what's happening in the Middle East. And that's why, frankly, there isn't more unrest in the United States over this, because, you know, by and large, people are not getting a good picture of what's happening.
Well, I was just before getting ready, I pulled up your name on Google. Google, the search function is awful, but just in the first page, they refer to you as a Kremlin shady horse, the controversial pro-Russian U.S. lawyer who got Sinn Féin's Declan Kearney in trouble for just talking to you.
Yeah,
they got a picture of you shaking his hand, and they demand that he apologize to the Irish people for that. And a number of other negative appellations that I'm sure you're well familiar with. What hope the American people when this is the state of the press? Or can you proudly claim ownership of some of those accusations?
No, I don't. I'm an independent force. Whatever I say because I want to, because I believe in it. I do want peace between the West and Russia. And I engage in what some call citizen diplomacy. The idea that I'm a shill for the Kremlin is just absurd. The Kremlin doesn't even know who I am. But this is a way to silence people, or to if not silence them, to isolate them and to, cut people off from supporting them and listening to them. And I assume that works to some degree, if not a large degree. I'll never know how well that works. Honestly, if I were totally honest about it, I find it absolutely depressing, again, that I did meet Declan Kearney. You know where I met him is in Egypt on a delegation over Gaza. We didn't talk about Russia or Ukraine once. And, of course, the story was somehow how Declan Kearney was, guilty by association for just meeting with me, for being some sort of, Russian stooge or whatever. I mean, it's just absurd, honestly. And but again, it's a way to try to cover up the truth by silencing truth makers and ridiculing them. And that's where we are at this point.
Well, yeah, and as I mentioned in the intro, maybe the Kremlin doesn't know who you are, but the TSA and the FBI and the CIA and the NSA, they might know who you are, Dan. You were harassed, as I've mentioned, other journalists and activists have been harassed in Britain and in Canada and in Germany. What was your story on returning from a Russian trip?
Yeah, well, actually, this was a trip. I was returning from Venezuela about almost exactly a month ago, and I flew into Miami via Bolivia, so Venezuela to Bolivia to Miami, and I was held in customs for 4 hours and interrogated. My phone was taken from me, presumably copied, and it was mailed back to me. I got it like 3 days later. My computer was taken and was given back to me before I was released after those 4 hours. And pretty much every time, not every time, but I'd say about 90% of the time I come back into the U.S., I am taken back for secondary interrogation. And that seems to be escalating, again, to the point where they took my phone and most likely copied it. I read about, the fact that customs now is they claim to be copying about 37,000 phones a year at the border, and they keep that data for 15 years. It's pretty incredible. I think most Americans don't know that can happen to them. And I think a lot of us in the position I'm in wonder what's next, whether they're, the FBI is going to come knocking on the door or whatever, like happened to Scott Ritter. I think the persecution is going to increase. And the reason for this, the reason for kind of the heightening ridicule also of independent journalists is that, the West cannot defend itself ideologically anymore. They can't defend what they're doing in Gaza, I mean, or Lebanon. It's impossible to. There's no defense for it. These are high crimes, and those who call them out on it, they're not even going to try to debate. They're just going to shut them down, and they're going to arrest them. And you're seeing that even on college campuses, elite college campuses, you know, the Ivy League schools, where the presidents of those schools, like my former school, my alma mater, Columbia University, its president is sending in the cops to beat up their own students because they cannot intellectually engage on these issues anymore.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, the, you know, Sarah Wilkinson in England, she her house was visited as she abused for her action, mostly with Palestine. Kit Clarenberg of the Gray Zone. They're also LaFredo is held in, well, he can't leave. He's out of prison right now in Israel. Another journalist with the Gray Zone nabbed and given the treatment, I'm sure, much worse than you got in the States from TSA, but they took his phone, his computer, and everything else. This seems to be de rigueur. And Richard Medhurst, another one in England, and suffering the same fate as Clarenberg did there as well, for the similar reasons that they're saying the wrong things about the wrong people, as in the view of the powers that be and call themselves the right, or claim the right, at least.
No, absolutely. And on October 7th in Germany, they were preemptively arresting people to try to prevent protest around the Palestinian issue. I mean, again, the West has given up on claiming it's democratic or, you know, talking about freedom. That's not on the menu anymore. I mean, and look, the fact is, when you support the type of atrocities that are happening in the Middle East right now, as the West is supporting, you better believe that the powers that be in the West, the same people supporting those atrocities, are willing to carry out those atrocities against us. And everyone has to be aware of that.
Yeah, well, empire always comes home. So, and also now we're fast out of time, Dan, and always goes too quickly, but I'll mention, and for most of our listeners, it'll be passed, but you can look it up, look up the interview. But you're going to be appearing with George Galloway on his Mother of All Talk Shows later today.
Yes, I am at 8 o'clock p.m. London time, and I'm looking forward to that. George is one of my heroes. He's a guy, a stalwart, who's never he's never shied from controversy or for standing up for what he believes in. So, yeah, I will be on there 8 o'clock London time to talk about Gaza and the Donbass as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can't imagine George Galloway shying away from anything.
No.
Well, Dan, it's always a joy to speak with you, and I really appreciate you coming on this tiny show when you're getting invites to such luminary programs as Moats. And I want to also thank Dimitri Lascaris for coming on all the way from Athens. That's all I've got for this week. Until the next time, thanks again, Dan, and take care with the TSA, eh?
Yes, thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore. And somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name of.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Sweet.